Now, always a cause for celebration in my life is a new David Hepworth book. He's the man who launched magazines like Q, Empire, Mojo, Smash Hits, and a whole lot more. Nobody writes about music like him. Some of the greats of the past few years include Never a Dull Moment, about 1971 being the best year for rock, Uncommon People, The Rise and Fall of Rock Stars, and A Fabulous Creation, How the LP Saved Our Lives, and others. Well, now he's got a book about the 1960s British invasion of America, and it's fantastic. It's called Overpaid, Oversexed, and Over There, How a Few Skinny Brits with Bad Teeth Rocked America. And I'm delighted to say David Hepworth is with us now. David, welcome to the programme. A seismic shift across the whole cultural terrain, and it didn't take years, it took days. The Beatles arrived in America, went on the Ed Sullivan Show, and conquered a continent before conquering the world. Is that it?
Well, the amazing thing is that, you know, there'd been no precedent for a British group or a group from anywhere other than the United States actually making it in the United States. So it was, you know, it seemed inconceivable before it happened. And even like 2-3 months before it happened, I mean, the American record company had no intention of putting out Beatles records in the United States. They thought, well, that's just for the UK. And then they changed their mind over the period of Christmas 1963 and decided to put these records out. And there was a sudden surge in demand. And I do think is one of the factors was the death of President Kennedy at the end of November had plunged the nation into kind of mass mourning. And when the Beatles came along at the beginning of February, there was an excuse to kind of cast off the mourning weeds and enjoy themselves. So when the Beatles arrived in America, America was absolutely primed for them. It just couldn't wait for them. And all the Beatles had to do was not screw it up. And the Beatles clearly didn't screw it up at all. And everybody knew that they had exciting music. But what nobody really knew until they arrived at Kennedy and did their first press conference was that they could just go in front of the cameras and just be themselves. And that was a massively entertaining and engaging thing in itself. And nobody had ever done that before. And one of the things I write about in the book is, aside from the music, I think the thing that America took to about the Beatles was the fact that they were a group. And America didn't really have groups. It had instrumental combos. It had loads of solo singers, all called Bobby. But it didn't have anything like the idea of a British group, of a bunch of mates, of a kind of gang. And what that supplied American teenagers with was the idea of a kind of an alternative family to which they could be allied. And that was a profoundly influential thing on American culture, musical culture, and culture generally. That's the thing that shifted, I think, is that idea of a group. And then you have factors that are very often glossed over, such as the hair. So when the Beatles arrived, you know, there was simply no press comment about the Beatles that did not mention their hair, probably in the first sentence. Because their hair was seen as revolutionary, which is extraordinary to us now. If you look at it, it's not particularly long. It's not particularly outrageous at all. But what it isn't is it's not greased back. It's not controlled. It's kind of boyish. It's, you know, it's kind of rough appearance as compared to the appearance of Elvis Presley or the Everly Brothers or whatever. And that was a massively influential thing on American youth. They all thought, this is revolutionary. Let's not put this stuff in our hair anymore. Let's comb it forward. And so he had all American youth overnight, pretty much, deciding that they were going to style themselves like the Beatles. And in many cases, even people like Bruce Springsteen can remember going to the supermarket and trying to impress the girl at the checkout with the idea that you had a British accent, whatever a British accent is, you know. But there were all these ways that American youth could get involved in this seemingly alien form of life from across the seas. And they did.
And they did all together in one go very quickly. I mean, just let's stay with the hair for a second. One thing you didn't mention about the hair, very important. I mean, you did mention Elvis, and the hair was very important to Elvis too. But we're talking here about hairstyles and the armed services, and obviously you only did it one way and whatever. And no matter what Elvis did with his hair, he made sure it was right. But with the Beatles, their hair moved.
Absolutely. And that was the thing. That was the key erotic moment in the Beatles' act.
Well, is it Paul and George? Is it
to kind of Rihanna? Would be pretty tame stuff. They, you know, it was when George and Paul, closed in on the same microphone and did the woo and shook their heads. And as they shook their heads, their hair moved. You know. And that was a profoundly exciting thing to 15-year-old girls, particularly right across the United States. It's amazing how powerful the hair was. Actually, my agent's still trying to get me to write a book about hair in popular music, which I still think it is the great undiscovered territory of popular music. It's all about hair.
Yeah, I remember Joe Elliott telling me that a certain member of his band, Def Leppard, lost an arm in an accident. He says, yeah, at least he didn't lose his hair. Anyway, where am I here? Yeah, look, I'll just go back to the details of this here, because timing is everything. And the funeral was the biggest thing on TV of President Kennedy at the end of 63. And in fact, you mentioned the charts. There's some English band in there that I've never heard of with You Don't Have to Cry to Be a Baby or something. And yes. Of the other 99 things in there in the top 100, they were all American, 19 or 20 of which were speeches of President Kennedy. So, like, there was nothing to suggest that anything might happen. Within a short space of time, the beginning of 64, it did all happen, and Beatlemania was happening in Britain, and then it was exported to America in a very clever way, although they lost every penny they could have, because Brian Epstein, he's a lovely guy, but it was too big for him. But when the Beatles came there in 64, I want to talk about just the doors that opened and other people that came through. And it might be fair to say that the band I'm just about to play something from now, who I'd say most people listening right now have never heard of, did better or got more out of it than anybody else. Here's Glad All Over from the Dave Clark Five. There you go, Glad All Over it is, from the Dave Clark Five, with the military beat that goes there, the singing drummer, etc. Just like, tell me about the Dave Clark Five and how clever that is. If somebody opens a door and you run through, what did he do or what did they do that was very different to the Beatles?
Well, they'd had a hit in Britain, you know, just in the wake of the Beatles. And so as the Beatles were coming back from America after their first visit, the Dave Clark Five were pretty much going out there. And so the door that had been kicked open by the Beatles, Dave Clark Five definitely profited from. Really interesting group. Came from North London, came from Tottenham. Dave Clark had a kind of showbiz background, and he was the person who was savvy enough to realize that he could manage himself. And he was also, don't laugh, the first indie group. Because what the Dave Clark Five did was they paid for making their own records. And therefore, they owned the masters. Everybody else did a normal deal with a record company. Dave Clark was incredibly shrewd, very, very hardworking, and they just plowed up and down the United States for 2 years, during which they probably made nearly as much money as the Beatles, and more to the point, probably kept more of it because of the way he'd organized things. They didn't have that. They didn't have that magic appeal to transfer them to the long run, you know, unlike the Rolling Stones and the Who and people like that. But for a couple of years, they were pretty much neck and neck with the Beatles. But they just didn't have that. They didn't have much charisma, really. They had that kind of military sound, which is still which still makes them popular as run-out music at sporting events all over the world. You know? So that's not to be sneezed at.
No, indeed not. But I mean, as you say, like, regardless of how popular they were pretty much kind of ignored in their home country, which is kind of a strange one, maybe much to Dave Clark's own chagrin. I mean, like, I've seen, like, he's a multimillionaire. I just looked him up there the other day. He's living in a £15 million mansion in London. He did very well down through the years. He bought Ready, Steady, Go off TV. This guy was pretty clever. The Beatles, like, as you say, you know, they simply were themselves. And what happened immediately with British culture and with British people, you say at one stage, it was an immediate kick, their uptick, as you call it, in British self-esteem right across the board, wasn't it?
Yeah, definitely, because I was like 14, 15 at the time, and I can remember this feeling, you know, the fact that the Beatles had made it in the States was so celebrated in the UK, because it was kind of, you know, it was confirmation that what we'd liked and we'd loved was worth liking and loving. And it was also, by extension, the kind of, well, if they like them, they like us as well. You know, they are representatives of us, you know. And I think it's an interesting thing, the kind of the nationalistic kind of dimension of these things. You know, like I mentioned later in the book, you know, you too did a very similar thing with the Republic of Ireland, it strikes me. You know what I mean? That if you're accepted in another country, everybody likes to feel they have a little bit of that acceptance themselves. So that's certainly how we felt in the UK in the mid-60s, as all these groups were going one after the other, and many of them having huge success in the United States. And also what that did was it expanded the world that they were competing in. Yeah. And so, you know, what you find is that if you don't make it in the United States, it's very difficult to sustain a career, because a career is built on the idea that you grow all the time. And if you don't do that, many is the case of a UK group that went to the United States, never made it, tried hard, came back, broke up.
Yeah,
because
indeed.
If you can't make it there, it's very difficult to keep going.
Okay, you do say you two happen to have the nationality that all Americans for some reason believe they have. This was far better than having the nationality that most Americans like to feel they've outgrown. I mean, much as that's later, I mean, I still want to mention the David Bowies and all that, which is very interesting about it. I never thought of it. I'll do it now. Why not jump all over the place? David Bowie went to America. I mean, like kind of late 60s kind of thing. This is jumping forward a bit now. And he didn't go, or early 70s maybe, with his manager Tony DeFreeze. He didn't go with Mick Ronson. He went by himself. He went on his own. And that was really good for David Bowie, wasn't it?
I think it was. He goes in 1971. He has like 2 or 3 weeks in February 1971. And he goes on his own. And I think he did that thing that loads of people, when they first go to America, if they go on their own, they absorb absolutely everything about them, everything around them. It's like being awake in a dream and being able to recall absolutely every detail the morning after. And what the David Bowie did in that tour, the 3 weeks when he zipped around all over the country, he went to New York, he went to Chicago, he went to Texas, he went to the West Coast and so forth, he kind of changed at every stage. So when he arrived in Los Angeles, he kind of bore no resemblance to the person who'd gone to New York, you know, a week or so earlier. And when he came back, you know, he had the idea of Ziggy Stardust. He'd listened to the Stooges and he'd listened to the Velvet Underground, all these things. And I think that trip to America for 2-3 weeks in February 1971 absolutely changed him. He came back talking about sidewalks and elevators. He came back with a very different view of the world. He came back feeling Beckenham could no longer contain him, you know. I think he got that surge of kind of ambition that America very often gives people. Yeah. You know, that's the thing that happens to people when you go to America. You think you're excited by the possibilities, well, and the scale of the place.
Being excited by the possibilities. I mean, first of all, by the way, we're talking to David Hepworth, overpaid, oversexed over there, and over there, how a few skinny Brits with bad teeth rocked America. And it's basically about the British invasion and the effect that it had over the subsequent years. And just to go back to what you say, like, I mean, Dave Clark working on a Friday, and then goes over the first time ever on a plane to America on a Saturday, appears in the Ed Sullivan Show 20 times or something along those lines, and was playing to like 70 million or 50 million, whatever it was, on the Sunday night kind of thing. I mean, that's how crazy. Get it right in the US and you're made, right?
Yeah, and also that was the same week they turned professional.
Sorry, that's the other one I forgot.
Same first plane, first hotel, turned professional, appeared on the world's biggest TV show.
Yeah, but
and
hold
people
on.
People tell you that pop music moves fast nowadays. Yeah. No, it doesn't.
No, it anyway. Doesn't. But I mean, the point about it is they didn't have what it took. And you say on page 31, they didn't have what it took to really endear themselves to people. And you say on page 31, what Paul McCartney wasn't to realise at that time was that it would be the things the Beatles gave no thought to that were to endear them to America. I mean, it was the Beatles just being themselves all the time, and the more they were themselves, the more famous they became. And at one stage then, you get to the World Cup in 66, Jeff Hurst running up the pitch, and Twiggy was in fashion, and Sunny Afternoon was the Kinks, and Michael Caine was in Alfie and all the rest. And then a few days later came Revolver, which is a completely part two, isn't it? It's a different thing altogether. Nobody would have expected this.
No, absolutely. But those are the groups that stuck around, were the groups who can make the transition from the single to the LP, which clearly the Beatles could do and the Rolling Stones could do and the Who could do and Dave Clark couldn't do. And also other really good groups who I think were hugely influential for a short period of time, like the Animals.
I knew you were going to say them next. In fact, I'm going to jump in with the Animals because you saw the Animals live, didn't you?
I did. First proper gig I ever saw was the Animals supporting Chuck Berry on a kind of package tour in Bradford when they played about four numbers.
But they didn't write their own stuff. Was that the beginning of the end for them?
Well, oddly enough, if you look at all the songs that they did, you know, Baby Let Me Take You Home, House of the Rising Sun, yeah, Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood, It's My Life, they're pretty much all American songs. Yeah. And the curious thing about the Animals was that they took American material and did it, in many cases, better than the Americans could do.
And this is where I'm going to use a phrase that goes to Newcastle, because that's where they're from. It's Newcastle going to America. And I'm just going to play a bit of this. It's one of the greatest songs of all time. Famous. It was on a Dylan album, etc. And it was well known. But look what the Animals did to it. Here it is. How's the Rising Sun?
There is a house in New Orleans. They call the Rising Sun. And it's been the ruin of many a poor boy. In God, I know I'm one.
There you go, House of the Rising Sun, which was just phenomenal. But even then, when you see House of the Rising Sun being performed, and you can see it on YouTube, like, they still wore the suits, didn't they? They still wore things that made it look like they might have been something English or whatever, whereas the Rolling Stones would step out of the back of a van and go on stage and nobody changed any clothes. So that was breaking the golden rule, as you would say, of, and we still have to use the word because that was the word right across the board, of showbiz. You definitely did not wear the same clothes on stage that you wore in real life.
Now, the funny thing about musical performers up until the Rolling Stones is it was axiomatic that you dressed for the music you played. So
yeah,
classical musicians played, you know, in tails and so forth, and you know, everybody played in their own kind of uniform, whereas the Rolling Stones had a new kind of uniform where they all wore something different. And that was a hugely important in making them really appealing in what I think is the key Rolling Stones medium, which was television, which was every time they appeared on television, you'd look at them and think, what are they wearing now? I want to see close-ups. I want to see that belt. I want to see that extraordinary pair of shoes that Mick's got. All that kind of detail. And here's the interesting thing, is that it was American fashion magazines like Vogue that were the first people to see that the Rolling Stones were kind of cool looking. And nobody had applied that lens, yeah, to them in the UK at all. It was Diana Vreeland, who was the editor of Vogue, who saw David Bailey's famous picture of Mick Jagger with the kind of fur hood that we still see, yeah, and said, that's beautiful. That's a new notion of male beauty. And, you know, so they were hugely important in that. But it was the lens of America that brought that out in them, you know, and made them as important as they were.
Well, as you say, the Stones are a Satisfaction, made in America, inspired by America. It just felt like America. It just was American. In fact, even then, when they were so pleased to go, because I mean, we know about Keith and Mick meeting on the train station, and they swap out the blues albums and all this kind of thing. And you know, Keith is obsessed with the blues, etc. And then they go to Chess, where they make the famous music. It was fantastic to be able to go there. And yeah, they do see Muddy Waters. He's in there painting the ceiling. I didn't know that.
Yes. Well, that's what you did in those days. You know, you worked for Leonard Chess, you worked for Leonard Chess. Yeah, but that first stab at recording Satisfaction was done in Chess Studios in Chicago, not very successfully. And then a few days later, they're in Hollywood in studios, RCA Studios in Hollywood, when by which time Keith has got the little fuzz tone and device, yeah. And Charlie has done something with the tempo. And they record Satisfaction, and I think they do it like twice, that's it. And Keith can't hear what it is that's good about it. He thinks it might make an album track. And everybody else is going, no, that's a hit record, you know. And then they put it out, and it was, you know, it was the biggest hit record of what was arguably the greatest year in the history of the 7-inch 45, which is 1965. And the thing that strikes me about Satisfaction, it was the first time they'd ever really written a song that was a hit. Mm. It's a song about your reaction to America. It's, you know, a man, you can't be a man because he doesn't smoke the same cigarettes as me.
Yeah.
All that kind of stuff. And they brilliantly mined that little seam, you know. And so you look at all the Rolling Stones singles after that, Get Up From My Cloud, Have You Seen Your Mother,
yeah.
Standing in the Shadows, Honky Tonk Women. They're all kind of American. They're all about America, but done in a way that sort of no American group could quite do it.
Do you know, earlier on I said I was going to get to Deep Purple and Led Zeppelin and everything else, which brings it in much later on, but I'm going to let people have to read that because we don't have an awful lot of time left, David, but there's so many other things I could mention. But one of the things is, to get back to the big point of it, was just the seismic shift that happened in the space of such a short space of time. And like, there's little details, by the way, I didn't necessarily know. Ed Sullivan didn't see screaming people at Heathrow Airport. He made it up. He was lying. I didn't know that. And Raymond Jones didn't come into the shop to buy a Beatles song. Are you telling me that story is not true? God.
All these things have been elaborated over the years.
Oh, I don't want to hear it. Okay, I'm going to block those bits out, because they did go in to buy the Beatles, and then the guy behind the counter, Brian Epstein, said, oh, I must check out this Beatles, and he went down to the cavern. That's good enough by me. I'm sticking with that. But one of the most important little things you have in the book, which I just think is fascinating, is this. Just all things British. I mean, obviously you go on about films and just blow up in particular, you mentioned in a big way, just the effect that it had, etc. And also the fact that a couple of brothers from Granada TV happened to be with cameras and were asked to go and do something with the Beatles. And for the first time ever, you saw kind of cinema verite, backstage, documentary kind of stuff. Like, they were the first with everything, fashion, the works, etc. But one of the things is Steve Van Zandt. Steve Van Zandt is a member of the E Street Band with Bruce Springsteen, just to go back to Bruce Springsteen. And when he formed a band, he called it The Mates. That's the whole thing to me in one sentence. It's brilliant.
Yes. Yes. That was during that period when American youth was just doing everything it could to ape English British style, you know. And so it was a natural thing to do. But it was also, it says something that, going back to the point about what was appealing about the Beatles, was the fact that they were friends.
Yeah.
And I think every 14-year-old likes to feel, my friends will be my friends for life. We will stay together. We will go into the adult world and we will achieve things as friends. They may not directly articulate this,
yeah.
But that's what they feel. Yeah. And that was the powerful thing about seeing the Beatles in Hard Day's Night. That was the thing that made your heart swell.
So listen, we could talk for an hour about A Hard Day's Night and even the little fashion that went with the lapel of Patty and the train or something, and the whole of America sold out the next day kind of stuff. But look, there's too much. And in fact, towards the very end too, with playing Penny Lane, Elvis Costello to President Obama and all that, just the way you put it into perspective, it's perfect, because that's England, etc. And roundabouts. What's a roundabout? All that kind of thing. Look, I tell you, read it for yourself. Is it the best book of the year? It's a David Hepworth book, of course. Is the best bloody book of the year. It's called Overpaid, Oversexed and Over There: How a Few Skinny Brits with Bad Teeth Rocked America. And I cannot wait for the next one. It's called Hair by David Hepworth. David, thank you so much, as usual, once again, for being with us on the programme today.
It's been a pleasure, Dave.
Come on. Thanks, David. See you. Thanks.
Cheers. Bye.